Before resuming our study today, I want to take a few minutes to introduce some special guests that are in the congregation today. First of all, some old friends. By that I mean that they're almost old as me. First of all, one of the deacons at Baraka Church, Alan Gensimer. Alan, welcome back to St. Louis. You have to stand up so they can see you. His wife, who is vice president of RB Theme Junior Bible Ministries in Houston, Texas, Shirley Gensimer. Head pencil pusher for both organizations, Terry Lebrano. And Terry is the daughter of Alan and Shirley. And then there's Frank. Where's Frank? I know he's here somewhere. There you are. Frank Lebrano. Now they have spawned. Terry and Frank have. And the oldest is Lindsay Lebrano. And I know Lindsay's here. And I'm not saying there she is in the blue. There's Lindsay. And many of you remember her from her last trip up here. And then her younger brother is Alexandros Lebrano. And you can tell by their outfits that they are going to entertain us today, but that will be prior to the second session. Now, the reason they're here, and I have a poop sheet here that'll make sure I tell all of this correctly. Lindsay and Alex are students at St. Thomas Episcopal School in Houston, Texas, where Lindsay is a junior this year and Alex is a freshman. And Lindsay completed, they are actually through. Lindsay competed this summer in the International Competition of Highland Dancing in Scotland, where she and her fellow dancers won over 120 medals. Carla Gardner, who is a classmate, is fourth in the world as a result of that competition, and the U.S. champion as well. Now, they actually placed in every dance, Lindsay placed in every dance, accumulating over 25 medals alone. Now, I don't know math too well, but that's like 20% of all the medals were accumulated by Lindsay. And it says here that they were there for the entire month of August, competing primarily on the weekends, as I understand it. So they had a tremendous time there. Now, I want to give you a little information about St. Thomas Episcopal School in Houston. It is a school where a pipe band was begun in the early 1960s when the school's founding rector, the Reverend T. Robert Ingram, decided he wanted a school band with a distinctive identity. And his love for his Scottish heritage led him to the bagpipes. And he decided a pipe band was just what the school needed. And getting a bunch of young Texan boys to learn the bagpipes and drums while wearing kilts was not an easy undertaking, but neither was saying no to Mr. Ingram. And Mr. Ingram contacted pipe major Donald Shaw Ramsey, who was then living in California. He came to the school for a number of years to conduct two-week workshops, and the church organist John Mosley began to learn the pipes so he could teach the students in Ramsey's absence, and the school's headmaster, Henry L. Walters, Jr., began teaching the drums. From these humble origins, the St. Thomas Episcopal School Pipe Band has grown to become one of the world's most respected pipe bands, winning Juvenile Pipe Band World Championships in 1985, 1995, 1998, 2004, and this recent August, 2006. And from this recent championship, bringing back a medal for that victory is Alex. He participated in the pipe and drum competition at yesterday's annual Scottish Games and Cultural Festival held at Forest Park, which is an annual event and which they have been attending regularly over the last several years. During that competition, Alex won the bronze medal in the Pibroch competition. Now, I'll spell that word for you. This is Gaelic. The spelling of the word is P-I-O-B-A-I-R-E-A-C-H-D. Pibroch. Much like French. He competed, no, I beg your pardon, Pebrick is composed of three modes, salute, gatherings, and lament. And it consists of a basic theme or ground, which is played at the beginning and then is repeated with increasingly complex variations that require extreme finger dexterity. The early forms were not written down, but simply passed from one generation to the next by the cantric system, spelled C-A-N-N-T-A-I-R-E-A-C-H-D, cantric. This is transmission of music by words and is unique to the Highland bagpipe music. To the uninitiated, it is an unintelligible jargon of syllables, but pipers train their student without any scales or notations, using the system to chant the tune to them. Possible evidence of bagpipes are found in the Old Testament's book of Daniel in the listing of the instruments found in the Babylonian Symphony Orchestra. The symphonia is the Hebrew word there. Now, at yesterday's competition, Alex played staghorns forever, or as they say in Scotland, kabar fade gubra. How'd I do? That's what he played, and he won a bronze medal for that. Now, Lindsay Lebrano competed in yesterday's annual Scottish Games and Cultural Festival at Forest Park, and she competed in three dances, Barracks Johnny, Highland Fling, and Chantreuse. And this, she, by the way, finished third in all of those competitions. The ones who beat her were collegians. And this morning, she will perform the dance Scottish Lilt, and more about that as we prepare for their performance leading into the second session. I welcome all of you Texans to St. Louis. We always applaud Texans here. Hand over the heart. Well, we're going to resume our study now. We have been, the past two or three weeks, defining the concept of an aristocracy, an aristocrat, a gentleman, and a lady. And this is made necessary because of the fact that Solomon was a boor. And he had many things to say to the Shulamite, many nice things, many accurate things, but he had wrong intentions. His desire was to incorporate her into his ever-growing harem. He had no redeemable qualities about himself at this time. He was in reversionism. He documented the various stages of reversionism and the resultant frantic searches for happiness in the book of Ecclesiastes, one of which was a frantic search for happiness through sex. And he ran into an individual named the Shulamite woman that stood fast behind doctrine and was not lured into his trap by his pickup lines. Now, we've run through 20-some-odd pickup lines that Solomon fired at the Shulamite, in which she successfully defended her soul by using Bible doctrine. And the last time we saw a pickup line from Solomon, he had lowered the level literally and figuratively and had said something that certainly no decent young gentleman would ever say to a young woman on the first day they had ever met, for Pete's sakes. And so we had to stop and observe the fact that Solomon was not a gentleman, but that what we need today in the United States of America is a young generation of ladies and gentlemen who know how to think under pressure, are not lured by the pickup lines of the day, and therefore do not have either their souls or their bodies damaged by poor decision-making under pressure, simply because they are entrapped by passions and desires that are legitimate in a romantic environment. But these things must be managed, and they are managed by doctrine in the soul and the development within the soul of integrity. And so today we have three vocabulary words we will address at the beginning, and we will note them as a group once done. First we have integrity, then probity, and then honor. These are mental attitudes that are imperative in the mind of an aristocrat. Now, in our study, we're developing definitions from English dictionaries that define an aristocrat and those words that define the mentality of such an individual. And as we do this, we are expanding the definitions as we move through to make it applicable to the Christian believer. The Christian who is advancing, the Christian who is accumulating doctrine in the soul, and the individual, therefore, who is building an inventory of ideas that will present himself into society as an individual with integrity. So integrity is the new word, and it is defined as follows. We'll note first the Oxford English Dictionary's definition of integrity. It's an unimpaired moral state. It is freedom from moral corruption. It is innocence. It is sinlessness. Soundness of moral principle. The character of uncorrupted virtue, especially in relation to truth and fair dealing. It is nice if you can run across a person with establishment integrity and you do business with him. If you have any type of an arrangement or association with a person of integrity, they are a person who can be trusted. Do you have integrity? Even on a human level. For integrity, as far as Christian aristocracy is concerned, goes beyond establishment integrity and takes on the thinking of God. Let's go now to Noah Webster. His 1828 American Dictionary of the English Language, and his definition of integrity. He writes that it is the entire unimpaired state of anything, particularly of the mind, moral soundness and purity, incorruptness. That's his word, incorruptness. Integrity comprehends the whole moral character, but it has special reference to uprightness in mutual dealings for others. So we see a relationship here from the disposition of integrity toward those outside the soul. In other words, others. But who are the others? We immediately think that the others to whom we are to display integrity are other fellow human beings. But it goes far beyond that. There must be integrity toward God first. Priority one is God. Do you reflect integrity toward God? And if you do, then you have an unimpaired not only moral state, but you have an unimpaired doctrinal inventory state. That's the inventory from which you draw in order to make decisions in life that have to do with your relationship toward God. And if you have a correct relationship toward God, then you will have a correct relationship toward the human race. Get your priorities in order. People worry about treating others correctly. You will not do that consistently until you get to the point to where you have integrity of soul with regard to God and His Word. So personal character must be based on truth. Now, establishment truth is one thing, and it is admirable to have it. You need that in the devil's world. But establishment truth only goes so far. There has to be the development in the soul of the believer of doctrinal truth whereby he can have an association with God on a sophisticated level. And that takes spiritual growth, and that takes time, and it also takes making doctrine priority one. Now, the next word is important. It is one called probity. It comes from the Latin probus, which means good and honest. So you see that these words are almost synonymous, but they are a little bit different as we move through them. And probity is different from integrity because it is tried virtue or tried integrity. In other words, you can know doctrine, you can have principles in your soul, but when you come under pressure and it's time to use it, the question arises, will you do it? For it might not be expedient to do it that day. It might not be the thing that would be approved of by those in your periphery. It might not be the popular thing to do. But will you do it? Do you have probity? You say, well, I have integrity. I've been coming to these boring Bible classes for 22 years. I've got all of this doctrine that's been taught here. So I have integrity of thought. But do you have integrity of application? That's probity. So it's tried virtue or integrity. It is proven integrity. It is moral excellence, integrity, uprightness, and honesty. Now back to Noah Webster. Primarily, probity is tried virtue or integrity, but in general, strict honesty, veracity, strict conformity of actions to the laws of justice. Probity of mind is best evidenced by probity of conduct. Probity of mind, see, we would call that integrity in our development here. Probity of mind or integrity is best evidenced by probity of conduct. That's application. And then he writes for social dealings and then continues, particularly in adhering to strict integrity in the observance and performance of rights called imperfect, which public laws do not reach and cannot enforce. There are many things that establishment do not address. And if establishment doesn't address an issue, then you must consult biblical data, doctrines, principles, what have you, in order to determine the rightness or wrongness of a given situation. And this is the problem that we see in this particular season we have as we lead into an election. I find it interesting to listen to politicians explain why they are for or against an issue. And then listen to the drivel that comes out because it may have some slight reference to establishment viewpoint, but it has absolutely no reference to biblical viewpoint. And therefore, there is a divide in this country within the electorate between what are called progressives and traditionalists. And we've been examining that problem for about 4 years now. And the progressives are those who simply have no base standard. They have no absolutes. They have some vague ideas that are good for them on that particular day, but tomorrow it may be different. But for the traditionalists, there are absolute standards that have been developed through the crucible of human history that have been proved to be perfect for the situation. And as these things have been tried in various cultures and various times and in various issues, you can look back over history and determine these are the permanent things. These are the things that work when they are applied by a society. And therefore, traditionalists go back and look at that and say, these things work. We install these concepts into our culture, and we will generally agree to go by these. We will structure our laws accordingly. And when this is lost, we lose absolutes, we lose the concept of right and wrong, and when that goes, then we have a blurred gray within the souls of the people, and the ability to make good decisions under pressure therefore suffers mightily, and over a period of time, there are historical downtrends within that society, and that is where we find ourselves today, and it amounts to the fact that if there's no internal integrity, there can be no application of probity. And so if there are public laws that don't cover something, that don't reach that far, then you need to have an inventory of ideas that instructs you about the rightness or the wrongness of that issue. And therefore, you can identify the guys on the TV as being big, fat, juicy liars. And if you want to know how to get through a political season, put a sign up on top of your TV. And whenever a political ad comes on, read the sign as they speak. They're speaking, you read the sign. They are lying. They are lying. Next word is honor. That'd be a good thing for people to have, wouldn't it? But honor can't come unless integrity and probity come first. Are you a person of honor? Well, if you don't have integrity, you don't have probity, and you can't have honor. Here are the definitions. This is from the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language. Esteem, respect, and reverence. It is a reputation. It is a good name. If you think correctly, you're going to decide correctly, and others will observe that, and you therefore will develop a reputation of honesty. And over a period of time, it will become clear whether you are a person of honor. You can fool some people some of the time. Boy, I'm sounding a whole lot like Abe Lincoln here. I am so embarrassed. But nevertheless, you can fool people some of the time, but not all of the time. And eventually it becomes very crystal clear that you are a fake and a fraud. And when you do the right thing, there are ulterior motives behind it. You're not a person of honor. And the reason you're not is because it's all about you. Everything's about you. and you manipulate people. You see to, deceive them. This is Sunday, isn't it? You will deceive them. You'll use duplicity. You'll manipulate and control in order to bring them around to your way of thinking so you can have your way. You do not make decisions based on absolute principles of establishment and biblical thought, which is the accumulation of integrity in the soul. And when you have that, then when the opportunity arises to apply it, you do this, and that's probity. And people see this over a period of time, and they understand you're a person of character and high moral thought and of Christian sophisticated function, and therefore you are a person of honor. And it takes time to establish that. And if you ever do something that causes others to think you are dishonest and you've simply just had a bad day, we all fail. Then you are going to have some time to reestablish your reputation among that group of people. So it's important to learn the doctrine, to get the absolutes, and then have the courage under the power of the Spirit to apply what you know and to do it day in and day out and build this reputation. Nobility of mind is the next definition. Personal integrity maintained without legal or other obligation. Personal integrity maintained without any legal or other obligation. You don't do it because you're obligated to do it. You do it because that's who you are, and that's how you think, and that's how you decide, and you are a person of honor. Now, there are some synonyms that are given that are helpful. The feeling or expression of admiration, respect, or esteem. Well, let's take a good definition. How about your father? Some people have good reputations, good relationships with their fathers. Some don't. Some don't have fathers. They died at an early age or what have you. But then that leads us back to a discussion of why our present study is so important. One of the major issues we're looking at is the crumbling and dissembling of the family in this country. No client nation can survive if the divine institutions enter into major downtrends. That all starts with volition, and volition is attacked when you tell an individual there are no absolutes. Therefore, the volition is not really challenged, is it? The volition can make up its mind based on what's good for me today. And so when you have a progressive idea that is infused into a society that says there are really no absolutes, it's just what's best for you, then volition is not as powerful as it was the day before. And then that attitude moves over into relationships with others. And so you can decide one day that Maureen is the one that you're going to tap on, and then the next day it's going to be Charlotte. And the day after that it's going to be Abigail. And after that it will be someone else. They will have a similar attitude with that relationship, and before long you have a very, very libertine society. And so the relationship between men and women become flawed, fuzzied, and therefore the attitude of right man, right woman loses out. And when that goes, then you have a situation that would be very, very favorable to Solomon. He had accomplished that in his environment. Any woman I'm attracted to, I get to have. If the relationship between the man and the woman in what is described in Scripture as a monogamous relationship becomes damaged, then you have all of these people running around cohabiting with each other, and there's no absolute definition of marriage, so that other people can come in and commit verbicide on it. For example, the homosexuals can say they can be married, and the people who would like to have more than one wife at a time can say they can be married to all of these people, up to 1,000 even, and on it goes. And what happens, therefore, to the family? What about the mother and the father and their relationship to their children under one roof, where there are absolute standards imposed upon the children by the leadership that has been designed and delegated to those children by God Himself? And so there's an erosion of the solidity of the family, and as the family degenerates, then so does the client nation. All of this, therefore, reflecting upon the fact that we are under frontal assault in the invisible war from the Luciferian rebellion against client nations. His only hope of expanding the time between now and when he has his comeuppance with the Lord is to diminish the number of people who are actually in the royal family, to confuse people who are in the family of God, to prevent them from even arriving there. And the environment in which all of these things take place are the divine institutions. So therefore, they must be under constant assault. The next generation of this country is going to determine whether we will return to historical uptrends or continue the downtrends. And this study is really directed toward young people who are nubile or are approaching that, but not yet married. Those of us who are married, it's over for us. We have made our decisions. How many times have people been married is inconsequential in this study. Decisions made in the past are not a part of this. My study is directed toward young people not yet married. They're the ones that will determine the future of this country with regard to putting to a stop the assault on the divine institutions. And if they don't have integrity in their souls, they cannot have probity, and they can't be people of honor, and thus they will be manipulated by the shenanigans of our day. So, we have these synonyms. The feeling or expression of admiration, respect, and esteem. That's honor. Other people view you that way. Now let me give you the proper perspective here. Do you want to have a good reputation within your community? Is that your objective, desire, hope? Well, I'll tell you something. That is the wrong attitude. You need to be respected by God first. And if you're respected by God based on the absolute principles that are communicated in His Word, then you will be respected by others who think like that in your community. You are not going to be respected by those on the other side of the aisle, namely the progressives. And you know how well you're doing, whether they like you or not. So here are some synonyms. Let's start with honor. The most general term is applicable both to the feeling and to the expression. Now, the feeling there, not necessarily emotion, it has to do with how another person feels about you. This is the way people write. They feel about you. What's their attitude toward you should be the better word. Homage is an expression of high regard. God have high regard for you. Reverence is a feeling of deep respect and devotion. Veneration is both a feeling and worshipful expression of respect, love, awe, especially for one whose wisdom, dignity, sacredness, rank, or age merits such attention. And you see, you take the father concept. Do you have these attitudes toward your earthly father? There may be reasons that you don't. But for those like me, I had a father I respect. I've never known a man with higher integrity than my dad. He did not brook any deviation from the standard. None. And so I have great honor and respect for him. Okay, now that is a good example of the Heavenly Father who is absolute in His standards and does not deviate. He's always there. He will always be with us. But He is always going to measure us by His righteous standards. And we will either be blessed by compliance or we will be disciplined for noncompliance. And an earthly father should take on that as instruction and a tutorial as to how to deal with their children. They, though, must have the integrity in order to exhibit it to their children. What happens, though, when you move into a society and you tear down the family and children either don't know their fathers, have a multiplicity of fathers, or hate the father or fathers that they have because the father or fathers that they have no integrity. Quentin Swofford tells me when kids come into Glen Haven down there, they have to be very careful about talking about God the Father. Because their idea of father is not very positive. So we have the word deference. Deference and respect or courteous regard for one who takes the form of yielding to his judgment or wishes. And now back to Noah Webster. In principle, honor is an upright disposition, moral rectitude of heart, that'd be your stream of consciousness, that gets into the cardia, a disposition to conform to justice and correct moral principles, or we might add correct moral and doctrinal principles. Then finally, actual conformity to justice and moral rectitude. When you have integrity and you have probity under pressure, then that is going to lead to the fact that you conform to righteous standards. That makes you a person of honor. Now, the last three words unite now to form a principle that we've noted in the past, but which give us some new vocabulary words by which to define it. So we've got us a new chart. And I call it the equation of honor. Doctrine produces integrity. Have a little foci here. I'm told by the text that when we get into the new place, we have big TV screens, widescreen HD. And we're able to see these better. But here's the gist of it. Doctrine produces integrity, which when put under pressure requires probity in order for integrity to be manifest as honor. Now here's the way it works. This D here represents doctrine resident in the stream of consciousness. So that's cardia right there. Doctrine in the stream of consciousness is epinosis. And the arrow here pointing to the right says that doctrine is going to produce something. And what it produces is integrity of soul. You stay with it long enough, there will develop within your inventory of ideas those doctrines that make you a person of integrity. Now you have to facilitate them. You can't just come to one Bible class and learn a principle and say, "Oh, that was very good, I like that," and then not come back for 6 months and forget all about it. You'll go back to the wheel tracks of wickedness you facilitated since you were two, and you'll forget all about that doctrine. So you have to stay with it so that you have within the cardia, within the stream of consciousness, as wheel tracks of righteousness, which means that's the path of least resistance. That's the thought process you go to under given stimuli. That's who you are. And so it produces integrity of soul. And there that sits right there. There's your inventory that now is primed for utilization. And when integrity of soul, right here, is placed under pressure, see that middle line there, under pressure, and the believer expresses probity toward doctrine, see that is tried integrity. In other words, it's time to apply probity toward doctrine. You are loyal to the inventory, under pressure. So that's the difference right there. You've got the information, and you can repeat it back, you can cite the verses in the King James, NIV, and New American Standard. But when you're placed under pressure, do you have probity? Will you apply it? Right then, right now, no going back. Probity toward doctrine. Then he is a person of honor, which is how integrity of soul is manifest to the world. If you're a person of honor, that's the way the others see you, starting with God. He's the guy that's actually got the clipboard. We have no clipboard committees except for Weldon. He tries to hustle up some prayers at halftime. So actually, I guess we could say Weldon is head of the clipboard committee here. And he goes around. If you don't want to pray, that's fine. And today there'll be no praying. We'll have no praying here today. But God's the one that's got the clipboard. He's the one keeping up. You go to Revelation 2:23, and it says he pulls an inventory every morning. I know what you're thinking. I'm taking a list and I'm keeping up. And when there are historical downtrends, there's going to be the various forms of divine discipline to hit the client nation. And when there are historical uptrends, there are going to be various forms of blessing to hit the client nation. And that's collective. It's also individual as well. So how's your inventory going? Are you a person of honor? God looks down on you, not only what you know. That's the important part. You can't decide on anything unless you have information by which to make that decision. And the information you need is the Word of God. And therefore, when an issue arises, you draw from that inventory in order to decide what to do. Well, that's your inventory under pressure. And then under pressure, if you do not deviate from the standard that you know, then you have probity. Therefore, you pull the trigger and make the right decision. Others see that, starting with God, and He says that was an honorable choice. And you're blessed for that. And other people, eventually, that can think clearly, they would have to be traditionalists, they would say that is a man of honor. And there are many ways by which you can develop honor in a society. Some people are just happy as punch with you. You just pay your bills and show up at church on Sunday. That's the way they do it in L.A. Now, you will go to church if you live in L.A. Doesn't matter whether you believe in Christ. Nobody's really quite interested in that. Did you show up and did you bring your Bible and did you bring your collection? That's the deal. Those are the rules. Everybody understands that. You show up, you bring your collection, you bring your Bible. You get 30 points for the Bible, only 10 for the collection. I always thought that was interesting. But nevertheless, that's how you get along in the South. Then you can do business. And as you do business, you buy things from other people and they send you a statement in the mail and then you write a check and send it back by the 10th of the month. And if everybody does that, you have honor in the community. He's a church-going man and he pays his bills. And he only has one wife, and if he runs around on her, we don't know. So he's cool. God's got a clipboard, sifts through all that crap. And you need to remember that first. So we've got this diagram here to rip through it one more time. Doctrine resident in the stream of consciousness produces integrity of soul. When integrity of soul is placed under pressure and the believer expresses probity toward doctrine, then he is a person of honor, which is how integrity of soul is manifest to the world. And, obviously, to God first. Now, honor is that which rightfully attracts esteem, such as dignity and courage, especially excellence of character. It is a keen sense of ethical conduct, a sense of what is right, of what is just, and what is true. Now, I feel like sometimes I'm speaking to the shadow people. The shadow people pay excellent attention. They don't move, no unnecessary movement among the shadow people. They don't seem to drift off. And they're always in attendance. But then there are those with flesh and blood who are breathing. And sometimes you drift off. And sometimes you grin. And sometimes you nod approval. And sometimes you glare. And then you go away. And I don't see you for a day or two. You come back, some of you. You sit there. And you listen. Now and then you'll say, "Oh, that was great this evening." Sometimes you don't say a word, which is better. The issue is, when it comes time to stand up for these principles of living that exhibit your orientation and adjustment of what is right and what is true and what is just, that's the issue. And you see, I don't have a clipboard. Some of you may be serial killers for all I know. I don't keep up with you except the very few that will associate with me. I don't know what you do. And it probably would shock hell if I were to find out. But the reason that all of this is fine is the door swings both ways. If we get prostitutes, bank robbers, killers, pillagers of cities, anybody that comes in here that will sit down and be quiet eventually can acquire this information and quit their tawdry ways. And if I know about it and other people know about what you've been into, first of all, the ascetic crowd is going to get very upset. We can't have that here. And then the lascivious crowd may be that said, "Hey, tell me more." So it's best for people not to know what you've been into. And just sit down, and I'm not saying you can't associate with each other. This deal about having so much privacy that to ask you, hi, how you doing? Well, why do you want to know? Are you a doctor? I don't mean that. I mean, it's not good to drill back into people's histories and say, tell me about what happened when you were, say, 17. That would be an invasion of privacy. Can you imagine the stories that could be told if we all raised our hands and said, let's have a confessional here this morning. Let's everybody come up and tell what we were doing when we were 17. And don't leave anything out. Anybody ready? Other than those who are 17. The point is that you have to develop this inventory and be willing to use it. And as you do, you transform your soul as per Romans 12:2. And you're becoming a person of honor. And that's the issue of coming here. And nobody needs to go back in time. A fastidious allegiance to the standards of one's profession, calling, or position. See, it's not considered a bad thing for when you're in a profession to be very good at it. We hope this, for example, for the Cardinals. And so it's good that when you're in a profession that you try to strive to be the best you can at that profession. That you learn how to do the things that are required by the expertise that you've decided to pursue. And everyone would stand back and applaud and say, he's really good at what he does. When it comes to living, it's a whole different thing. Or he's too strict. He's too riveted. He's too much into that doctrine. Personal integrity maintained without legal or other obligation indicates that's how you think, because that's what's in your soul that is facilitated, and thus that's who you are. And you never consider doing it any other way. The Greek word for honor is timē and means value, reverence, respect, and high esteem. And the presence of those who are both honorable and dishonorable in a local church is Paul's subject in 2 Timothy 2 verses 20 and 21. And he writes there that in a large house, that's local church compared to a private residence, there are not only gold and silver vessels, that's believers who are advancing. See, the gold would be spiritual maturity, the silver would be sophisticated spiritual life. But also those of wood and clay, believers who are carnal and reversionistic. In fact, there are some who are honorable, positive to doctrine, some who are dishonorable, those negative to doctrine. Therefore, verse 21, if one has cleansed himself, that's rebound from his carnal status, maybe he will, maybe he won't, but if he does, he shall be a vessel of honor through spiritual advance to the sophisticated spiritual life. See, there's an advanced process there. Why? Because he has been sanctified, set apart as separate through experiential sanctification. And some people believe they're sanctified. They get a little doctrine in some circles, get a little doctrine, think they know a few Bible verses. They claim, I'm sanctified, I don't sin anymore. I always thought that was funny. A person claiming, I don't sin anymore, when they've just sinned. They just bold-faced lied right there. Okay, because he has been sanctified, and that's experiential sanctification, and is useful to the master, the owner of the vessel, which is God, having become prepared for the purpose of every good work, prepared to produce divine good through the execution of inner integrity, through probity, becoming a person of honor in the sight of God as well as man. Well, that does our study for those three vocabulary words. We'll find out if you're among genteel society in the second session. We'll pause now for tea and crumpets, and when we come back, we'll have a little Highland dancing, a little bagpipe playing, a little jig or two. Put us back here at about 5 till the hour.